against the lawlessness of Trump. The norms that are championed by religious groups, they're not there. The labor unions are weak. The citizenry is not organized.
Ralph, we're going to have to leave it there.
Congress is under the Constitution
as we
to make Trump obey the laws.
We have to leave it there, Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, and former presidential candidate. This is Democracy Now! As we continue our discussion of President Jimmy Carter's legacy, we look at his policies in the Middle East and North Africa, in particular Israel and Palestine. Thursday, during the funeral, President Carter's former advisor, Stuart Eisenstadt, praised Carter's work on facilitating the Camp David peace accords between Israel and Egypt in 78.
Jimmy Carter's most lasting achievement, and the one I think he was most proud of, was to bring the first peace to the Middle East through the greatest act of personal diplomacy in American history, the Camp David Accords. For 13 days and nights, he negotiated with Israel's Menachem Begin and Egypt's Anwar Sadat, personally drafting more than 20 peace proposals and shuttling them between the Israeli and Egyptian delegations. And he saved the agreement at the 11th hour, and it was the 11th hour, by appealing to Begin's love of his grandchildren. For the past 45 years, the Egypt-Israel peace treaty has never been violated and laid the foundation for the Abraham Accords.
The Abraham Accords are the bilateral normalization agreements between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Israel and Bahrain, signed in 2020. In 2006, years after he left office, Jimmy Carter wrote a book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, in which he compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians to South Africa's former racist regime. It was striking for a former U.S. president to use the words Palestine, let alone apartheid, in referring to the occupied territories. I went down to the Carter Center to speak with President Jimmy Carter about the controversy around his book and what he wanted the world to understand.
The word apartheid is exactly accurate. You know, this is an area that's occupied by two powers. They're now completely separated. The Palestinians can't even ride on the same roads that the Israelis have created or built in Palestinian territory. The Israelis never see a Palestinian except their Israeli soldiers. The Palestinians never see an Israeli except at a distance, except the Israeli soldiers. So within Palestinian territory, they're absolutely and totally separated, much worse than they were in South Africa, by the way. And the other thing is, the other definition of apartheid is one side dominates the other. And the Israelis completely dominate the life of the Palestinian people.
Why don't Americans know what you have seen?
Americans don't want to know. And many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land. I think it's accurate to say that not a single member of Congress with whom I'm familiar would possibly speak out and call for Israel to withdraw to their legal boundaries or to publicize the plight of the Palestinians, or even to call publicly and repeatedly for good faith peace talks. There hadn't been a day of peace talks now in more than 7 years. So this is a taboo subject. And I would say that if any member of Congress did speak out, as I've just described, they would probably not be back into Congress the next term.
President Jimmy Carter, to see that whole interview we did at the Carter Center, you can go to democracynow.org. For more on his legacy in the Middle East during his presidency and beyond, we're joined in London by historian Seth Anaziska, professor of Jewish-Muslim relations at University College London, author of Preventing Palestine, a political history from Camp David to Oslo. What should we understand about the legacy of President Carter, Professor Anaziska?
Well, thank you, Amy. I think primarily the biggest lesson is that when he came into office, he was the first U.S. president to talk about the idea of a Palestinian homeland alongside his commitment to Israeli security. And that was an enormous change from what had come before and what's come since. And I think that the way we understand Carter's legacy should very much be oriented around the very deep commitment he had to justice and a resolution of the Palestinian question alongside his commitment to Israel, which derived very much from his Southern Baptist faith.
And talk about the whole trajectory. Talk about the Camp David Accords, for which he was hailed throughout the various funeral services this week and has been hailed in many places around the world.
Well, I think one of the biggest misunderstandings about the legacy of Camp David is that this is not at all what Carter had intended or had hoped for when he came into office. He actually had a much more comprehensive vision of peace in the Middle East that included a resolution of the Palestinian component, but also peace with Syria, with Jordan. And he came up with some of these ideas, developed them with Cyrus Vance, his Secretary of State, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, his National Security Advisor. And in developing those ideas, which came out in 1977 in a very closely held memo that was not widely shared inside the administration, he actually talked about return of refugees. He talked about the status of Jerusalem. And he desired very much to think about the different components of the regional settlement as part of an overall vision. This was in contrast to Henry Kissinger's attitude of piecemeal diplomacy that had preceded him in the aftermath of the 1973 war. So we can understand Carter in this way very much as a departure and somebody who understood the value and the necessity of contending with these much broader regional dynamics. Now, the reasons why this ended up with a far more limited but very significant bilateral peace treaty between Egypt and Israel had a lot to do both with the election of Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in 1977, as well as the position of Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat, and also the role of the Palestinians and the PLO. But what people don't quite recall or understand is that Camp David and the agreement towards the peace treaty was in many ways a compromise, or in Brzezinski's view, was a real departure from what had been the intention. And that gap between what people had hoped for within the administration and what ended up emerging in 1979 with the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty also was tethered very much to the perpetuation of Palestinian statelessness. So if we want to understand why and how Palestinians have been deprived of sovereignty or remain stateless to this day, we have to go back to think about the impact of Camp David itself.
Interesting that Sadat would be assassinated years later in Egypt. When Carter was on the plane with Nixon and Ford, that's when they say that cemented his relationship with Ford, while they hardly talked to Nixon at all. But if you could also comment on President Carter and post-President Carter. I mean, the fact that he wrote this book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, using the word Palestine, using the word apartheid to refer to the occupied territories. I remember him chasing him down the hall at the Democratic Convention when he was supposed to speak. This was the Obama Democratic Convention. And it ended up he didn't speak. And I chased him and Roseland because—
Remember that in 1977, there was a very famous speech that he gave in Clinton, Massachusetts, talking about a Palestinian homeland. And that raised huge hackles, both in the American Jewish community, amongst American Jewish leaders who were very uncomfortable and were already distrustful of a Southern Democrat and his views on Israel, but also Cold War conservatives who were quite hawkish and felt that he was far too close to engaging with the Soviet Union. And so both of those constituencies were very, very opposed to his attitude and his approach on the Palestinian issue. And I think we can see echoes of that in how he then was treated after his presidency, when much of his activism and much of his engagement on the question of Palestine t- to my view, derived from a sense of frustration and regret about what he was not able to achieve in the Camp David Accords. And his commitment stemmed from the same values that he had been shaped by early on, a sense of viewing the Palestinian issue through the same lens as civil rights and the same lens as what he experienced in the South, which is often what his biographers have explained, where his views and approach towards the Palestinians came from, but also a particularly close relationship to biblical views around Israel and Zionism that he was very, very much committed to Israeli security as a result. And that was never something that he let go of, even if you look closely at his work in Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Some of his views on Israel are actually quite closely aligned with positions that many in the Jewish community would feel comfortable with. The fact that people criticized and attacked him for that, I think, speaks to the taboo of talking about what's happening or what has happened in the context of Israel and Palestine in the same kind of language as disenfranchisement around race in apartheid South Africa. And of course, as Carter said in the interview you just ran that you had done with him when the book came out, the situation is far worse in actuality with what is happening vis-a-vis Israel's treatment of Palestinians.
Seth Anazisko, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor of Jewish-Muslim Relations at University College London, author of Preventing Palestine, A Political History from Camp David to Oslo, speaking to us from London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, the late President Jimmy Carter is remembered as the human rights president. But as we continue our critical look at the life and legacy of President Carter, we turn now to Southeast Asia, where his legacy is more complicated. When I spoke to President Carter at the Carter Center in 2007, he discussed his regrets over sending weapons to Indonesia during its brutal occupation of East Timor.
I was wondering, in your time as president, the period that Indonesia occupied Timor, if you regret the allowing of Indonesia to buy U.S. weapons at a time when it was the one of the worst times for the people of Timor.
Well, as you may know, I had a policy when I was president of not selling weapons if it would exacerbate a potential conflict in any region of the world. And some of our allies were very irate about this policy. And I have to say that I was not, you know, as thoroughly briefed about what was going on in East Timor as I should have been. I was more concerned about other parts of the world then.
For more on President Carter's legacy in Indonesia and East Timor, we're joined by Brad Simpson, professor of history at the University of Connecticut, author of Economists with Guns, Authoritarian Development and U.S.-Indonesian Relations. He founded the Indonesia-East Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, which provided thousands of U.S. documents to East Timor's Truth Commission, which were used in its final report. Professor Simpson, thanks so much for being with us. Talk about the legacy of President Carter when it comes to Southeast Asia, and start with Indonesia's occupation of East Timor.
Thank you for having me on the show, Amy, and it's good to be with you. I think that we should recall that in 1975, the United States effectively pulled out of Southeast Asia just as Indonesia was invading East Timor with U.S. support on December 7, 1975, shortly after President Ford and then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger left Jakarta. Indonesia invaded East Timor. Over the course of the next year, they killed upwards of 10% of the population, an invasion that was entirely financed and armed by U.S. weapons. The CIA estimated that about 95% of the weapons used by Indonesia in its invasion were provided by the United States. And so when Jimmy Carter became president in January of 1977, he confronted an ongoing genocide, which many officials and journalists were already describing as the worst human rights crisis in the world at the time. And Jimmy Carter, like his top officials, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and Zbigniew Brzezinski, were primarily concerned with reassuring right-wing allies in the region, such as Indonesian President Suharto, Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, and the South Korean government, that the United States was still committed to providing military and economic assistance. And we see this right from the start, that when Carter was evaluating his policies towards Southeast Asia, his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, reassured his staffers that the Carter administration would not be and should not be prioritizing human rights in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Southeast Asia and the end of the Vietnam War. And throughout Carter's administration, although Carter himself may have been sympathetic to human rights in other parts of the world and actually did curtail U.S. military assistance to governments in Latin America and was very good, for example, on enforcing an arms embargo against Rhodesia, in Southeast Asia, Carter really continued the policies of the Nixon and Ford administration. Between 1977 and 1979, the Carter administration more than doubled U.S. military aid and sales to Indonesia, precisely at the moment when the atrocities that Indonesia was carrying out, which included mass murder, the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of people, and starvation and disease that killed tens of thousands, was escalating into a genocide. And the Carter administration's response, at least those of his top officials, was to lie before Congress. In the spring of 1977, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke and his deputies lied to Congress and said that Indonesia had effective control of East Timor, that the situation was calm, and that the majority of those who had died had died before Indonesia's invasion. And they used these lies to justify continuing to expand military assistance and weapon sales at a time when congressional human rights supporters and some human rights supporters within his own administration, including the new Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, Patricia Darien, were calling on the Carter administration to halt weapon sales and weapons aid to Indonesia because of the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in East Timor. And the Carter administration's response was pretty illuminating. The CIA in the spring of 1977 and into 1978 told the Carter administration that Indonesia was literally running out of weapons, running out of bullets and bombs because of the intensity of its bombardment of East Timor, and that the Suharto regime was requesting a doubling of military assistance so it could more effectively prosecute that war. And in 1978, the Carter administration actually increased military sales to Indonesia, including the provision of ground attack fighters such as OV-10 Broncos, A-4 and F-5 ground attack fighters, which the administration knew would be used to bomb and attack the defenseless civilian population of East Timor.
Brad, we just have a minute to go. If you can summarize the presidency to the post-presidency, the post-president Carter, and the human rights framework he put forward that was applied and not applied in different situations.
I think we should acknowledge that President Carter was the first president to elevate human rights to an idea that should guide U.S. foreign policy, at least in theory. I think what he also showed is how difficult it is for even well-intentioned presidents to support human rights when the vast majority of the U.S. foreign policy apparatus believes in a more hawkish foreign policy that's designed to support military dictators around the world with U.S. military aid and sales. And the fact that Carter was not able to sort of elevate human rights as he might have wished in East Timor and Indonesia is a reminder of the challenges that activists and human rights supporters in the U.S. and around the world face in trying to get the United States to actually support human rights and do more than give lip service to the idea that human rights should be a guiding principle in U.S. foreign policy.
Brad Simpson, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, University of Connecticut, author of Economists with Guns, Authoritarian Development in U.S.-Indonesian Relations, founded the Indonesia's Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. To see our documentary, Massacre, The Story of East Timor, which I did with journalist Alan Nairn, about one of the great genocides of the late 20th century, that was Indonesia's occupation of East Timor, killing off a third of the population, go to democracynow.org. Next up, will President Biden pardon a longtime immigrant rights leader facing detention and deportation? Stay with us.
En su boca donde se funde el mar, en el páramo de la paz.
bajan hacia esta vena que Rodrigo de Bastidas bautizó. El nombre de una Palestina que nació Magdalena, el pueblo de Magdalena. Un pueblito que se llamaba Al-Mashdal y ahora se llama Mintal.
Vio de las Tumbas by Nicholas Jaar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Longtime immigrant rights activist Ravi Ragbir faces deportation and detention Monday when he goes for a check-in with ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, here in New York. Democracy Now! Has covered Ravi's fight to stop his own deportation since 2006. His work as former head of the New Sanctuary Coalition, he came to the U.S. from Trinidad and Tobago 30 years ago, but a 2001 wire fraud conviction made his green card subject to review. Both the judge and the prosecutor in his case said Ravi was a low-level employee who was a, quote, casualty of a con artist. And the judge told him, quote, you're not a criminal, and I know that I am never going to see you again, he said. Ravi Ragbir is married to a U.S. citizen and has a U.S.-born daughter. But ICE has refused to normalize his status or stop his required check-ins. In 2022, Ravi and his legal team reached a settlement in a First Amendment lawsuit that ICE would not deport him for 3 years as he worked to stay in the U.S. On Wednesday, he rallied with hundreds of immigrant justice activists at the state capitol in Albany to demand lawmakers enact legislation to protect immigrant New Yorkers ahead of Trump's return to office. Ravi's also requested a presidential pardon, but the Biden administration has yet to respond. Faith leaders and others will speak at a vigil Monday outside the ICE office in Manhattan that supported can attend as Ravi checks in. Others are being asked to sign an online petition. Ravi and his lawyer, Alina Das, join us now, along with Ravi's wife. Alina is co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law. Amy Gottlieb is U.S. Migration Director for the American Friends Service Committee. And Ravi Ragbir, I know it is awkward for you because you've spent so many years working on behalf of other people to be here in your own capacity requesting a pardon. Talk about what needs to happen at this point and why you fear on Monday that at your normal check-in, you could be taken.
Well, this, you have to go back to 2018 when it was a normal check-in. We heard and we saw what happened. So we never, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, you're never sure what is going to happen. Once you go into that building, you, your family, your friends, your community don't know if you will walk back out. And that is a fear we all face, myself, especially on Monday, we'll be facing on Monday when I check in. Each day for the last few, since December 16, I've had to remember to breathe, right? Remember how to take one step forward. And so it's, I'm in emotional baskets. I've been doing this fight for many years, right? Not about just about me, but about the humanity of the policy, the humanity of the agency, the humanity of how many lives have been destroyed. So you ask me what is going to happen. I actually cannot answer that right now. I will throw it to my attorney, Alina Das, to respond.
So, Alina, it's great to see you again. We've covered this case for years. I went to court in New Jersey when you were there on your free speech case, whether you were being targeted as a migrant rights leader in your own personal situation. Alina, I think you were pregnant at the time, and your kids are now growing up. Explain how Ravi can ultimately not be deported.
Absolutely. So it's been a privilege to be on this journey with Ravi for the past 16 years as his lawyer. And I have watched him fight tirelessly for other people, even when the law gave him so few options to fight for himself. And so that's why this pardon campaign is so important. I was there, with Ravi and Amy in 2018 when ICE tried to take him away in retaliation for his activism. And
all the people marching outside the federal building time after time.
Absolutely. And we had to have that community support and legal intervention just to get him some temporary protection from deportation. And that's now expiring. So we're walking into the check-in on Monday, uncertain of how much time Ravi has left. But the good news is that President Biden can be the one to end this once and for all. He has the power to give Ravi a pardon, and that pardon will ensure that as a green card holder, Ravi will be able to remain here in the U.S. because he's facing a double punishment for a conviction that he received 24 years ago, for which he's already served his time. And I'm proud to say that faith leaders who have seen Ravi give to others, who've seen the sacrifices that he has made, they are leading this fight for the pardon. They believe, they have faith that Biden will do the right thing, that that Biden will not allow us to face the next 4 years without the people who helped us survive the first Trump administration. They have faith that Biden will do this for everyone. We submitted this pardon 8 years ago. It's been completely vetted and reviewed. The judge who presided over Ravi's criminal conviction and his trial supports the pardon. And so many other elected officials, faith leaders have come out in support. This is a way that we can keep Ravi together with his family to honor the sacrifices that Ravi, that Amy, that the entire community have made over the years and to show, you know, Ravi is a beacon of hope for so many. And we need this victory right now.
Amy Gottlieb, you're Ravi's wife. You're also head of what? Migration, the U.S. Programs, American Friends Service Committee, a well-known lawyer yourself. I remember when you wrote the piece in the New York Times, when you're fighting for Ravi's free First Amendment rights. You two are married. You're married to a U.S. citizen. You have a U.S. citizen daughter. How is this happening right now?
I mean, as Alina said, you know, we have a history of immigration laws that are unforgiving, right? We don't allow people to be able to move forward in their lives if they've ever had even a smallest contact with the criminal legal system. And so,
and in your case, the judge said you were not a criminal. Right. He sentenced you the least possible he could, saying that you were collateral damage of a case. And even the prosecutor talked about you favorably.
Yeah. So, you know, we ask that question all the time. How is this happening? My family asks that question all the time. He's here. We've been married almost 15 years, right? Ravi's been in this struggle for so many years. We are surrounded by community, but we don't know what's going to happen on Monday. And it is unsettling, to say the least. It is exhausting. But we are in it because we truly continue to believe that there is light at the end of this tunnel. There has to be. There absolutely must be. It's why I do the work I do. It's why we all continue to be part of this struggle together, because there's only one way forward.
Ravi, I give you the final word.
The final word is, even though in our fear, in our anxiety, in our uncertainty of what is going to happen, we still need to stand up. We still need to speak up. We still need to hold on to each other. We still need to be there for each other. Even as we go into to the den of lions, unknown of monsters, not knowing what is going to happen, I still have to walk in there. And the people that support me and surround me are walking with me, and that day we need to walk with others who are going through the same. We need to stop what is happening.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We'll certainly report what happens on Monday. President Biden is in office for another, 10 days? And we will be there on every day raising these questions. Ravi Ragbir, his lawyer Alina Das, co-director of Immigrants Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law, and Amy Gottlieb, U.S. Migration Director for the American Friends Service Committee. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Anjali Kamat, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Hannah Elias, our Executive Director, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley is our Director, John Randolph, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Connection to our community matters. Local radio is the link. When you tune in wherever you are, you're part of a conversation that makes us all stronger. But local stations aren't getting the support they deserve from the government. Your support is vital. We're asking you to support the Community Radio Initiative. Write the government. Tell them how important this station is. MyCRI.ca is the place to get all the information so we can work together to make a difference. MyCRI.ca.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.